It's called an EC out.
Yes. Sometimes called a screw extractor. That sounds like a possibility. Although, I'm not convinced that the rest of his jammed screw is only going to be any easier to move with an EC out than it is with the head of the screw that he's now got. I'm hoping that he's going to do it, Joe. Sounds like Rich had a further comment. Go ahead, Rich.
What I said before about, you know, making two flats on either side of the screw head so you can put a wrench on it or a vice grip or a wrench with a breaker bar. I've had very good luck on cars doing that, along with taking a little WD-40, you know, where the screw goes into the block, let's say, and then just really a very slight bit of heat. I know I once was working on a car that had lug nuts. I could not get the lug nuts off for love of money with a star wrench. I remember I took a little WD-40, sprayed it on the lug nuts, and really didn't use a lot of heat. I used a regular Bernzomatic torch, but just glanced it over the nuts for just a couple of seconds. I was amazed how easy I was able to back those bolts out.
Did you back away from the mic?
Okay, Barry, what would you do in a case like this?
Hi, incidentally. I would use the reverse. They have a drill bit set that you have, and then you have this thing that you thread into it, and you reverse it. And also, I would heat it and a little bit, and I would put that WD-40 and YWD-40 and not just conventional oil, because I think it's the silicone spray and it can take the heat better without evaporating. I'm pretty sure that's what that's all about. Over.
Got a final idea from Kate to Katie White.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, Rich just reminded me. Okay, you've got a stuck lug bolt. You heat it up, and then like the mechanic, the guys know, you know, the little secret. While they got the wrench on it, like the four-way wrench, they hit the wrench with a hammer. In other words, while it's heated, and that shock of hitting it with a hammer usually gives it that extra, you know, pull or whatever, and that extra shock, and breaks it loose. So what you do, if you heat it up, now let's say he puts on a bolt, he puts a screwdriver, I don't know if a screwdriver or a wrench on the bolt. While it's heating up, I put a vice grip on it, and while it's heated, then smack the vice grip with a hammer, and that shock and the heat usually will break it loose. Take over.
Okay, TJ. Eric recognized. One other thing I'm going to inject here is that in the case of caliper brakes, disc brakes on an automobile, the bleed valve on top is usually made out of very cheap steel and rusts itself into the main body. A buddy of mine has developed a trick where he will fill up the whole area with WD-40 a day before and let that cook for a day, so to speak. Quite often that does the job. Eric, KE2EJ, go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm a fan of drilling a hole using an EZ-out, but what I usually do is I take Freon, or if I'm lucky enough to have liquid nitrogen, which has happened actually on a couple of occasions, I'll actually pump some Freon into the hole that I drilled for the EZ-out. Wait a little while, cool the screw down, let it shrink a little bit, then put a little WD-40 on it, and you don't need any parts, it just comes right out.
KC2TMA.
KC2TMA, recognized. The Freon, is that quick freeze when you say Freon? Because not very many of us have liquid nitrogen. So is it quick freeze that you use for the Freon? Eric, go ahead.
No, today it would be a Freon replacement. Quick freeze is good stuff. That gets you about minus 20, minus... I think quick freeze is around minus 20. It's actually a methane-based compound, not fluorocarbon. But yeah, that's a good stuff. That you can get that at any electronics place.
Okay, stand by, Harry. It sounded like KC2 Tango Mike Alpha, but that can't possibly be. So KC2 TMA, it sounded like that. Give us your real call, your name, and your comment.
Kilo Charlie 2 Tango Mike Echo. And just going to say, you know, I work in an automotive garage and a mechanic. And the best thing to do is when you can't get a bleeder valve off or something breaks on it, just what we use a PB blaster. Break down anything, oxidation that, you know, builds up in between it. You let it sit for 20 minutes. And it's best to get yourself a good set of flare nut wrenches. And you'll never have a problem with getting the bleeder valve off if that's your problem.
Okay, you real quick gave us something that we've never heard before, PB blaster. You're going to have to spell that out, tell us what it is, where do you buy it, what does it cost, what does it stand for? Over to you, Nick.
Quick comment on PB blaster. Plus there was a test done on other things to loosen rusted bolts. But yeah, if I can get in there, I'll definitely give you the information. This is KC2, Whiskey Alpha Delta. Standing by.
Okay, but back to Dick, Nick. Tango Mike Echo, what is PB Blaster, Nick? Go ahead.
PB Blaster just breaks down any oxidation between two metals. You know, use it a lot on, bolts and nuts, and mainly on brake systems because, you know, sometimes when you get, like, two different metals between the hub of the car, you know, the hub and the rotor, that oxidizes, and you can't break that free. Even if you hit it with a sledgehammer, you won't break it. So PB Blaster just breaks down any oxidation between two different metals. It's cheap. You get any, like, Ace Hardware or something.
Calling it PB Blaster? Paul Baker Blaster? Is that what you're calling it?
Yeah, it turns out that you're so close to it, Nick, that you don't realize that we're thoroughly unknowledgeable on what you're talking about. PB Blaster sounded like a tool. Now I realize it sounds like chemistry. That's to giving us a few more words. So it's a jar, a can, a spray, or whatever of chemistry that you can buy in an aftermarket place for automobile parts. Is that what you're describing, Nick? KC2 TME, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Yeah, it's an aerosol spray can, you know. It's just like WD-40. It's just a different, you know, it's just how, you know, you spray WD-40 on any nuts and bolts. You just spray this on anything, and it comes out like a liquid. Spray in and it just breaks down oxidation between two metals. And a lot of times what happens is when people try to bleed their brakes, they strip the bleeder valve because you're not supposed to use a regular wrench. You're supposed to get flare nut wrenches, which are meant for any soft fit-ins on a fuel line or brake fit-ins or something. Flare nut wrenches and PB Blaster, and you can, you know, do all the brake bleeding you ever want to do.
How do you spell it?
Fanatics on that stick, WS2N.
How do you spell it? Yeah, is it Bravo? Is it Papa Bravo Blaster? Sounds to me like it's a more enthusiastic kind of chemistry than WD-40. Also, a smart person will always use a socket wrench or a flare nut wrench on the bleeder valve for a disc brake system. However, if he hasn't done something to break the bond between the cheap screws that are frozen together, because our brake fluid is highly hygroscopic, it really attracts moisture, creates an awful lot of rust, and therefore that bleeder valve becomes really jammed in there. So even with a flare nut wrench or a socket wrench, it's extremely easy to break off that bleeder valve. And when it comes to brake cylinders being rebuilt, I suspect that 80% of them are rebuilt because the bleeder valve is jammed and broken off, even though they used the right tool. Not stripped, broken off. And the person wasn't willing to drill out the old one and re-tap and so on, so he just replaced the whole cylinder. That's what I think is going on. So is it Papa Bravo Blaster, Nick, KC2 TME, K2RIW?
Yeah, it's Papa Bravo Blaster. And, you say about a hygroscopic brake fluid. That's dot 5. You got dot 3, 4, and 5. Dot 3 and 4, same thing, except they have a different boiling point. DOT-5 is a silicone based fluid, and it's more hygroscopic, like you said. It traps water, it bubbles up. Most cars are DOT-3 and DOT-4, so water doesn't affect, you know, the water won't affect it, because with a flat, you know, I do plenty of brake changes, and I use flanet wrenches for all bleeder valves. I never broke one, never stripped one.
This call from 4326.
This is KCZ, KC2, excuse me. This is KC2, WAD. Can I make a quick comment?
Sounds like somebody's trying to break into the internet.
Hey, Dick. Stand by, Eric. Go ahead, Ralph. KC2, WAD. You got it, Ralph.
All right. All brake fluids trap water, and the water stays on the bottom of all the master cylinder and wheel cylinder parts. So whenever you see a pitted wheel cylinder or anything, the water's always on the bottom. Oil floats. Anyway, I just read a wonderful article, and it compared all the nuts busting, quote-unquote, things that are available. WD-40, da-da-da-da-da, PP Blaster. Guess what the best thing was? I don't know how they did it, how they set it up. That was all
wrong about the water.
This is what they said. If you mix acetone and automatic transmission fluid and you apply that to your rusted item that you want to loosen, the worst case was something like WD-40. All right. They used like a 7/8-inch thread stud and nut that were rusted. That took 400 foot-pounds of torque to loosen. All right. They went PB Blaster. That took something like 120 foot-pounds of torque to loosen. This mix of acetone and automatic transmission fluid took 60 foot-pounds of torque to loosen. I just wanted to throw that in there. I do listen, and this was in, it was published in the magazine. I gotta find it, because now somebody's gonna ask me where did I see that. But I don't have the answer right here, but a mix of acetone and automatic transmission fluid was better than any product for loosening rusted items. This is KC2WAD, Central New Jersey. Standing by.
Acetone and transmission fluid. I'll try that on the next brake change.
Yeah, the next question on that one, Ralph, Farmingdale, New Jersey is where he's from. What's your guess as to the mixture ratio of acetone and automatic tranny fluid? Do you think it was about 50-50? Back to you, Ralph.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was 50-50.
Good comment.
Yeah, stand by, Harry. Listen, Eric is next, and then Harry in that order. Eric, go right ahead and wait for the beep, Eric.
Oh, I think KDRWK2J.
I'm looking at the MSDS, and it says that the PE Blaster is made out of 40 to 50% naphtha, 30 to 40% petroleum distillates hydrotreated, 20 to 30% petroleum distillate solvent dewaxed, and 3% of alcohols ethoxylated. So that's the composition. That stuff will actually drive any water out. It's similar in composition to WD-40.
It sounds like a stoochier version. Harry, what would you do in a case like this? You got it, Harry.
In a case like this, it's called liquid wrench. Let it sit for 5 minutes, and I guarantee you'll come out. I had a sensor, a relay sensor that goes to the catalytic converter, and I had to get it out. That's been sitting there about maybe 10 years. I sprayed liquid wrench on it, waited about 10, 15 minutes, right off.
Liquid wrench is another good one. KC2 TLE.
So anyway, might have been, was that a thing in aluminum? See, you know, that could play a point. Alrighty then. I just wanted to throw that in there. Again, this is me talking to you. KC2, WAD, standing by. Yeah, I gotta find the publication that listed this. Really, you'll find it very interesting.
Yeah, all of us are not waiting long enough for the machine to reset. And that can have some disadvantages. You've got to wait until you hear the beep before you start talking. Timing is important. Any piece of chemistry takes time to do its work. So when you're pouring on PB Blaster or Liquid Wrench or WD-40 or whatever, you got to give it some time. Many minutes, hours, in some cases a day. And how fast the chemistry works is also a function of temperature. Every time you raise the temperature of a reactant by 10 degrees centigrade, the rate of reaction doubles. So combination of temperature and time, and let the penetration take place, that can do wonders. And it certainly does work with bleeder valves on brakes. And one of the questions I've got for you, Nick, is that I suspect a significant number of brake systems on our roads today have a little bit of water in the cylinder, the brake cylinder. That in turn creates rust. The rust creates a partial jamming action between the piston and the cylinder. When you press down on the brakes with the automatic brake systems we have, the power assist, fluid pressure can go to infinity and it moves the piston and you get braking action. That's the good news. But because of the partially jammed piston, the brake doesn't retract the way it's supposed to, and you get a dragging brake pad. I'll bet you've seen lots of action, lots of evidence of dragging brake pads on certain automobiles. KC2 TME for a comment on that. Wait for the beep. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2EV. Yes, KC2 TME. Most of the time, when the piston doesn't come back, it's because inside the piston in the caliper, there's a little seal. It's in the shape of a square. It's called a square cut seal. And when you apply the brakes, that seal stretches, and when you let off the brakes, that little square seal, it's like a rubber square seal, is what pulls back the piston. Most of the time, it's when that square cut seal rips or it's dried out, the brakes won't return. And so your pads will warp, you know, your pads will stay kind of against the rotor, and so they get build up a lot of friction. And then when you go to hit the brakes, you gotta hit the brakes hard because you need to stop short. You're gonna generate so much heat that actually what you're doing, you're gonna get brake fade. And where the brakes get so hot that they release themselves, and you're going to be pulling a steering wheel over your forehead. That's how hard you can be pulling on it. And you have no brakes.
Quick comment on that. The runout on the disc generally returns the pistons with the runout and pushes the wheel cylinders back. Yeah, I don't buy what he's saying there. Now, the runout on the disc will push the pads and make them back away from the disc.
Okay, if you don't believe me, I'm okay with that, you know. Been a mechanic for years, built plenty of calibers, but we'll go by what you say.
Oh, I'm a mechanic for 49 years, all right? I'm just saying, generally, the run out on a disc is what returns stuff away from being applied. Yeah, I like the stretchy story on the seals and in the holding the pistons. I understand that. I know that helps. But the run out of the disc is ultimately the last factor that gets the brakes turned off once you get your foot off the pedal.
Ralph, I've had a Ford, let's see now, what was this, a Ford product, Mercury station wagon. I think it was a Mercury station wagon, where the rusting of the piston into the cylinder was so bad. Run out, relaxation of rubber, square seal, everything. Didn't release that brake. It stayed engaged, and I was dragging the pad on that particular disc for lots and lots of miles until I could get to a place to have it repaired. So there were degrees of jamming of the piston depending on the level of rust and how long the system is going between proper service. And I had let mine go on much too long. So run out can do it up to a point. But I have seen degrees of rusting between the piston and cylinder on a caliper brake system where it does not release. Until you hit it with a hammer, it wouldn't release. It was that bad. In fact, getting that caliper off of the disc was a very difficult process, and it had worn itself all kinds of grooves into the disc also. I know we're pretty far off the original subject that Joe asked, and it looks like we've discovered quite a bit of exciting chemistry with time, with temperature, that can help him loosen this rusted steel bolt in an aluminum housing of his Larson antenna. And if you have any further questions, further comments on methods of loosing a steel screw from an aluminum tapped hole, give us your call letters, and if not, we're going to go back to Joe, K2LIW listening.
K2MDG.
KC2TMA.
WAD.
Yeah. We never got into the rusting thing, so drop that. And if you let your calipers get that bad, shame on you. Yeah, for the original question, which is the first time I've heard it, yeah, get the hot liquid wrench out. That would be even as something as simple as a propane torch. Yeah, you warm the aluminum. Aluminum melts at 1,100 degrees Fahrenheit. So don't go crazy. But make it hot enough that if you put some water on it, it's sizzling, or you put your fingers on it, and it hurts. So warm the aluminum to a temperature that you can't touch it. That expands the aluminum. Shoot your WD-40, your PB Blaster, or anything. Shoot it in there when it's hot. Keep shooting it until it cools down, and then go ahead and it'll just unscrew. Yeah, I've done this millions of times. I was a Yamaha motorcycle dealer, so guess how many broken off things I had to get that were steel out of aluminum pieces. Okie doke. We'll leave it at that. Get old. KC2WAD down here in central New Jersey. Guarantee you. You warm the aluminum up. Aluminum expands faster. Stay away from the steel anyway. But no, it'll loosen it up enough, and that'll be the thing that'll do the job. Okay, clear. I'll be standing by. I want to listen to any other answers.
KC2TMA, question.
Nick recognized, but Steve was ahead of you. Go ahead, Steve. KC2MDB.
Okay, Dick, yeah, all very good ideas for getting the bolt out. Just a quick comment once he gets the bolt out. Before he puts the new bolt, whatever it may be, in there, put a little Tenetrox, no lock. I think you get it at your local home. Free compound to use electrical connection and stuff. And never have that problem again if you try to take the thing apart. Back to you.
Yeah, there's another product called Anti-Seize, which would do the same thing.
Yeah, we heard everything you said, Steve, but your signal is kind of noisy, but you'd like to know about that. Nick, KC2TME, go right ahead.
Yeah, I was watching TV the other day on how it's made, and they were showing how they made WD-40. They had, like, a little history thing on it. Did anybody, like, I didn't realize, never knew this until I watched the show, but WD-40 means water displacement perfected on the 40th try. They made it during World War II. Because the nuts and bolts on the World War II fighter planes were seized up, and they made that to loosen them, to help them loosen it.
Good to know, Nick. Thank you. And some of you guys who factor that Joe is running into, the B2RYY, is the guy who asked the original question, is that he's taking apart a Larson antenna, and the steel bolt in question into a tapped aluminum hole or into an aluminum housing, that bolt is holding down a plastic structure that's part of the gamma match of the antenna. So there's a limit as to how much heat he can use before damaging that structure. Interesting set of questions you gave us here, Joe. MB2RYY, K2RIW.
Well, Dick, I always try to bring something interesting to the tech net.
Yes, you did. Sounds like you have no further questions or comments. Sounds like we've given you a bunch of suggestions. We've given you some homework. And when you come back after you perform all of these operations, we'll let you, you'll let us know how it's going to go. Is that true, Joe?
Yes. Maybe it'll take me a week, maybe a little more, but eventually we'll get the thing apart one way or the other. I'm going to try not to drill it out. I'm going to try to, you know, take it out the right way, sack it out. So that is that. I have a comment about the test engine on the antenna last week. Remember I was asking about the, using a low-level signal. I used a higher power signal on the same frequency, and the results are kind of interesting.
Yeah, Joe, one of the things that you've brought to my attention on many occasions is that when I pick up without waiting for the beep, you let me know about it, and twice now you've done that. Now that you've got a real signal on 2585, you're not waiting for the beep at times. Go ahead and tell us what you did with, I think this was the direction-finding situation, or, no, let me think, what was now last week's question? Is with reference to, you'll have to repeat it. Go ahead, Joe.
You're right, I didn't wait for the beep. I was testing a couple of station masters, comparing my station master on a building to another one, and I used a real higher, much higher power level. It's both the antennas doing the same kind of test on a specific frequency, one operating frequency. It yielded, actually, my antenna actually produced a 1 dB higher signal than the other guy's antenna did on the same frequency being received by his equipment for the same antenna. So the only difference is the slight difference in, I guess, transmission line length. Actually, that didn't seem to make much difference because I used a 30-foot piece of line going between his transmitter output and his antenna because I had to, you know, be able to reach into the room to attach to my antenna. So I used an extra 30-foot piece of line, which when I took out later on, made a negligible difference in the actual overall field strength reading. So it seemed like my antenna actually is working correctly with a high power signal applied to it. So why my own transmitter doesn't work correctly, that's another issue. I'm going to have to get into some other day, but at least the antenna seems to work. But it is kind of tough proving this kind of stuff out because, you know, without having, I guess, a way of testing or comparing against something else, it's tough testing any antenna to really find out if it truly is radiating, you know, completely radiating correctly compared to something else that, you know, that's known good. And by the way, the signal level received at, say, 3.5 miles away was about a minus 31 dBm signal into the same kind of station master at about 100 foot.
Yes, I remember you were comparing two antennas, and you were getting erroneous readings from your point of view as to how strong the RSSI, received signal strength indication, was when you transmitted your antenna versus the other antenna. And I think by the higher signal strength, first of all, no antenna will change, no reasonable antenna will change its pattern, gain, front-to-back ratio, front-to-side ratio, or anything else as a function of power. Whatever pattern you get out of an antenna at 1 milliwatt, 1 watt, or 1 kilowatt should be the exact same pattern. The higher power giving you more reasonable results tells me that there was either a degree of nonlinearity in the receiving system where the signal strength was being measured and or an extraneous signal. If there was a source of noise or other weak signal present during the experiment, it can give you erroneous results. By you using a stronger signal on each antenna sequentially being tested, climbing above receiver noise and any other extraneous signal noise, allows the RSSI now to see the real thing as opposed to being contaminated by those other things. That's a guess on my part. I wonder if you think that's possible, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2MU. I heard you, K2MU, just a moment. Well, I was originally testing with a power level of plus 20 dBm. and the other power level I was using was plus 56 dBm.
Sounds right. K2MU, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. The name here is Bernie. I like to listen into the tech net. Just a minor detail. The gentleman that commented on the WD-40, he had it half right, the water displacement on the 40th try, but I just checked it out on Wikipedia because I remembered it was used for the Atlas rocket, and sure enough, first use was by the Convair company. They were looking for some solvent to protect the Atlas rocket from moisture on the skin. So a minor detail, but I just thought I'd throw in my 2 cents in the name of accuracy, and I'll be back on the side listening to the TechNet T2MU.
Very fine, Bernie. Bernie from Bayside. The Wikipedia is one of my favorites, although there's an occasional error in Wikipedia, because you could say it's a customer supply information. It really is a kind of peer-reviewed information, because if there are errors there, and zillions of people read it, they start complaining, and the error gets corrected pretty fast. Some of the nexus explanations will come out of Wikipedia. And such, when I want a particular piece of information, quite often I Google the keyword, and then put after the keyword, plus Wikipedia. In other words, I want the Wikipedia result as an answer. And for me, it ends up as a happy situation. It's kind of amazing the amount of information we take for granted that we're all able to get on the Internet these days. Back in the days when you used to have to go to a library, hope it was a good technical library, hope they had the right book in stock to give you the answer, and go leafing through the book to find the right page. It's got the graph or the spreadsheet or whatever. We all forget about the dark days before Internet. The good news about the Internet that it's giving us a lot of information in a hurry. Got to be a little bit careful about not being too selective with that information. There is a French respected individual who has written an article letting everyone believe that RF energy is dangerous and it's giving us brain cancer. There's one article like that. And so if a person starts off with an opinion that RF energy is dangerous, and he finds that one article, he says, aha. And he ignores all the other articles. So you got to be a little bit careful about the data. Also, another nice factor about the Internet is we have extremely fast communication. There's a guy who works for, let me drop. There's a guy who works for the Southern Observatory, European Southern Observatory, ESO. A fascinating guy to talk to. And I send emails to him. He lives in La Salina, Chile, is where he used to live. He's now moved to a slightly different town. And back and forth, we can send multiple messages per hour. Think about the days when you used to send snail mail. I don't care if it was airmail or whatever, to send a letter to Chile, which is part of South America. We take you some real time to get there. So information nowadays is fast. However, if you watch 60 Minutes tonight, you found out that the fast information on the Internet is giving us a vulnerability. There are some nasty people out there that are attacking our military secure systems and our power systems. And they've already done so in the case of Brazil. Somebody tapped into the Internet connection to the power system in Brazil and turned up the power in a particular town. And that can create a lot of havoc. So adding the security required is a constant battle. Pluses and minuses in everything we do. Anyone have any further questions or comments on all of the above? And I think did I get a chance to go back to everybody who wanted a chance? Harry, did you get a chance to give your answer? KC2SIR, K2RIW? Sounds like he did. Anyone with any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else?
KC2, Whiskey Alpha Delta.
And Ralph recognized in that order. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
I can never understand why certain things that are very strategic have to be on the Internet. We ran the power grids and all that stuff years ago without connecting it to the Internet so that the people now have access maybe somewhere or another to really going to create who knows what kind of disruption. Isn't there a way that it could be on a separate, secure, even twisted wire, you know, intercommunications between strategic places, such as power plants or whatever, and keep it off the internet where it's vulnerable, Vic, over?
You're right. You have to anticipate these problems. It's obviously done with the internet because of convenience. I mean, I got a power station in Detroit, Michigan, and I got another power station somewhere in upper New York State, and I want to be able to communicate between the two. To connect them both to the internet is overly easy. But boy, you better be very crafty on the way you set up the security system so that people don't hack into it. To set up a completely separate phone line, wired RF line, or whatever, between Detroit and upper New York State, that's not easy. The internet is there, and it's an easy trap to fall into. So I sort of see how it happened, but we're learning many lessons. In the case of the 60 Minutes program tonight, they guessed that in the military system what had happened is somebody had left these small portable memory devices laying around on the table. Somebody picked up one and plugged it into a machine, and the memory device had been programmed in such a way to install a Trojan program, I guess is what I would call it, install some malware into the computer that it was connected to, which created a back door by which the bad guys now had access to that secure computer system. And so, for the time being, the defense is that all of these portable memory devices are no longer allowed to be connected to these secure computers. When I was doing some somewhat secure work 10 or 15 years ago, we had special rooms where the computers were put with special interlocks and whatever, so that no one else could see the screen, so that no one else had access to those machines. It's not easy. Let's see, somebody just signed in, and my memory is so short. I guess it was Ralph, KC2WAD. Wait long enough, Ralph, until you hear a beep, and then start talking. You got it, Ralph, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay there, Dick. KQRIW. Yeah, this is KC2WAD, Farmingdale, New Jersey, a little bit west of Asbury Park. Yeah, I'm amazed I'm able to talk to you guys on that repeater. But, yeah, I just wanted to say one last argument on the aluminum with the metal screw and plastic involved. You can start heating the aluminum away from the plastic. Obviously, aluminum is a pretty good conductor of heat. So you can heat in an area, you know, just a propane torch. Just warm it up and keep it away from the plastic until you can spit on your finger and touch the area. And that's warm enough. And then, yeah, I heard all the chemistry results from a couple of the other listeners that came in on WD-40, et cetera. But WD-40, that's a long time ago. But this article, and seriously, I'll try to find it and get back to you with the published article. But it'd be interesting to see what is the difference, molecule size or whatever, of using this 50-50 mix of acetone and ATF.
Net tonight at 8
but that came out the winner out of the all the other rusty nut loosening sprays that were out there. But there's no doubt about it. A little bit of heat, put something on it, and then as it cools, it'll suck the stuff in, and then just wiggle it back and forth. But that's, I've been doing this for 60 years, so, or excuse me, that was a miss. Yeah, so I've been doing it for close to 50 years, and yeah. Alrighty, well, this has been a pleasure, absolutely. I just got the license the end of last month. So this is KC2WAD. Enjoyed listening to everybody out there in the group.
Yeah, it's good that Farmingdale, New Jersey is able to get into this repeater, which is located, 15 or 20 miles east of New York City on the border of the two counties on Long Island called Nassau and Queens. It's right at that border is where this repeater is located. The repeater also has a carefully controlled antenna pattern with a null toward Frenchtown, New Jersey, because there is a repeater in Frenchtown on the exact same frequency pair. So by steering a null in that direction, the two repeaters don't interfere with each other very much. So you're kind of fortunate, Ralph, that you're in a direction from this repeater where you're not in that null. Some people are and have great trouble getting in from New Jersey, even though the distance is not great. Now, one of the things that I've been saying on the TechNet over the months and years is that, to my knowledge, not only do the only people with real hands-on experience and smart on the way wireless equipment works are the ham radio operators, because they're doing it, touching it, using it, comparing notes with other people, and so they're running an indirect educational apprenticeship-like program to learn how transmitters and receivers and propagation really works. I've also often said that inside of each true ham radio operator, to some degree, there's a scientist trying to get out. And one of the things I heard this week while listening to the 146.43 or 44 repeater in Connecticut was a group of guys discussing APRS and balloons. APRS has at least two different meanings. Automatic packet repeater system or automatic positioning repeater system. So with this protocol called APRS, you can set up a chunk of electronics on a balloon, launch the balloon, and I guess there's also a global positioning satellite receiver co-located. And so periodically the balloon will say, here's where I am. This is my latitude, longitude, and altitude. And the ham radio launched balloons to date have hit an altitude record of 122,000 feet. Google the word APRS plus balloon plus ham radio or whatever, various combinations like that, and you'll be able to read some of these articles. Fascinating stuff. And some of these guys will put a camera on board so that the balloon gets up to 100,000 feet, takes a photograph. In some cases, the balloon is designed, let me drop. The balloon is a design that gets up to a high enough altitude where the pressure gets low enough and the balloon expands and pops. There's a parachute on board and a chunk of electronics comes back down and reports where it is and helps you find it, if you know what I mean, even though it may land in a tree somewhere or two states away. So, fascinating project. And I think there's an attempt, I don't know if it's been succeeded yet, to launch a balloon so it gets up to the jet stream, hopefully gets to an altitude where it stays into the jet stream, and goes from the United States to Europe. I don't know if that one has been successful yet, but there have been a number of balloons launched in the New England and Canadian area. When you start reading these articles, you'll find out that these amateur-built chunks of electronics on a balloon have done some exciting things. I'm a little bit amazed that none of the articles mention FAA approval or whatever. I guess, in general, it's a small device, not very dangerous to civilian aircraft. However, if one of these things got sucked into a jet engine, I think there's a slim chance it can create a little bit of grief. But there seems to be no rules on these as long as they're kept small enough. Wonder if any of you guys have heard about these balloon-launched APRS chunks of electronics and what you think of all this. You got any comments on all of the above? Give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW on the TechNet. Kind of amazed nobody's got any opinions on that one. Among the radio-controlled model airplane enthusiasts, Maynard Hill is a guy, a very famous guy, who way back in the late 60s was inventing an automatic leveling system for a radio-controlled airplane, which used the fact that there is a voltage gradient across the atmosphere. The ionosphere, not only is it something like 60 kilometers up, but the ionosphere, because of some of the actions of the physics of this Earth and the ultraviolet rays and whatever, ends up something like a third of a million volts more positive than the Earth's surface. So on a reasonably dry day, or a day with reasonable humidity, there is a voltage gradient between ionosphere and Earth, and if you have a sensitive enough, if you have a voltage sensing system that is high enough in impedance, sensitive enough, it can sense that difference in voltage versus altitude, like you could say there's one huge capacitor between the ionosphere and the Earth with a third of a million volts across it. And so if you put a sensor on each wingtip of a radio control model airplane and bring it into a high enough impedance voltmeter, if the right-hand wing of the plane is a little bit higher than the left-hand wing, it'll be a little bit closer to the ionosphere. It'll send some more positive voltage, put that into a feedback servo mechanism, and the airplane will automatically level itself. Do the same thing between the tip of the rudder versus the wings or the nose, and you can now make an airplane that automatically levels itself in both yaw, pitch, and roll. Do I have that right? Yeah. Maybe not in yaw. Yaw you'll determine by an ordinary magnetic compass. But pitch and roll, you can determine that by way of this automatic sensing system. So Maynard Hill and his group of merry men out of the Washington, Maryland area built a model airplane with the right program on board with a global positioning satellite receiver system and this automatic leveling. And they made about four attempts over about 3 years to launch an airplane from the United States over to Ireland. And when it gets close to Ireland, and I believe the airplane had also something like an automatic position reporting system, an APRS ham radio protocol system on board, it would tell you where the airplane's located. So as it approached the coast of Ireland, the radio control operators that were pre-arranged in Ireland would take over the control and land the airplane. And as I said, it took about four attempts, but they did succeed in doing that, making a remotely piloted vehicle, a reasonable, normal-sized radio control model airplane, launched it from Maryland. Well, I think they actually launched it from Nova Scotia. They wanted the path to be as short as possible. And it did go over to Ireland, finally. Not too different than these much more simple systems with the balloons. Maynard Hill had a lot of trouble finding the right setting for the needle valve of the engine because that wasn't part of his automatic system. I was writing notes to him at the time telling him that you really ought to make some kind of a servo mechanism on the engine because if the needle valve is set a little bit too fine, the engine is running lean, it won't get enough lubrication and it won't last long enough to get all the way over to Ireland. Or also, I was worried about the fact that the tiniest speck of dirt in the fuel getting into the needle valve will change the fuel setting. And if there's a more automatic system, particularly as the aircraft gets lighter when it uses up its fuel supply, there's a more desirable setting for the engine. But they did manage to succeed. Kind of fascinating projects. Of the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio.
Reflector, 9126, link clear.
I guess, Eric, I timed out the link by talking too long. Is that approximately what happened? KE2EJ, if you're there. K2LIW.
KC2WAD.
Yes, that is what you did, Dick, because you're timing out the Eastern repeater. If I can hear a disconnect and it reconnects, my note does the same thing. If you have a carrier on long enough, 4 minutes, apparently, you disconnect and just reflect automatically.
And if I give a delay time long enough, does everything get reset? Joe, go ahead.
That would be an error question to answer you because I have no idea how long this the COS tracks the receiver up there in Glen Oaks. If it's instantaneous, if it's got a kind of delay lag, apparently it's got a lag. Because I hear you let the thing go from time to time, which means it's a not a 4 minute span of continuous key down, but I still hear the Eastern transmitter disconnect occasionally, so something is not correct here. You probably have to leave a longer space than actually what you hear when the beep goes off, the courtesy tone.
Yeah, I'm testing. I'm checking right now, and I see that the Eastern link is down. Let me double check.
It's down because you're disconnected from Reflector 9126. It's no longer connected. It may be connected, but you're not. Didn't you just hear it go off on here?
Sure did. And twice in a row, you didn't wait for the beep. Okay, Ralph, KC2WAD, go right ahead. I think you want to make a further comment.
Oh, yeah. I used to work in Holmdel at Bell Labs, AT&T, which, of course, turned into Lucent. But, I'm talking probably 1985, 1986. And, we had a RC group So I built all kinds of weird planes and had elevators, had this, I had that. It was a whole lot of fun. So eventually, I put a camera in the belly of a small balsa wood airplane and flew this thing over and was from the ground able to use that as a 7-channel helicopter radio. But I forget what I used, but I had a servo and it was a switch. I think it was for landing gear or something. So I'd use the switch, and every time I hit the switch, I would count as I checked on the ground, 1001, 1002, 1003. And the camera had cycles. So I knew after counted the three like that, everything was ready for the next picture. But I took some unbelievable photographs, 35mm film, with the, it was like a plastic throwaway camera, but it was auto-wind, and I used an extra servo, a balsa wood stick, and just pushed on the on the shutter button. But, I'm curious. This Canada to Ireland RC plane, how big of a fuel tank did they have on that thing?
Yeah, if you Google the word Maynard Hill and transatlantic flight or whatever, various combinations like that, you'll be able to read about this thing. I saw the photograph of the airplane. It looks to me like it had a wingspan of about 4 feet. And the fuel was an ordinary fuel tank on board, obviously much larger than normal size, because I think the actual flight time was in the vicinity of 25 hours. So it was an extremely efficient engine, the right mixture of fuel. The majority of the payload of the airplane, of course, was the fuel load. And I don't know the exact size, but kind of a fascinating project. The remotely piloted vehicles can do some really great things. Let me drop. I see that the Eastern Repeater still hasn't come back. If you're really interested in electric-powered radio control model aircraft, one of the biggest events in the United States is called the NEAT Fair. I think it's pronounced NEAT, Northeast Aero Technology, I think it stands for. Anyhow, in Schnapple, New York is where they hold an event in September, and I believe they've done it 7 years in a row now. And there's a brand new class of flyers, which I guess they've got a fancy name for it, and I've forgotten the name, but I'm going to call it virtual piloting, where you wear this headset where you're literally looking through the camera. There's a radio link between the camera on the radio control aircraft and the ground and eventually to your headset. So by way of wearing this headset, you are virtually in the cockpit of that radio control model airplane and flying it. And kind of fascinating to look at the playback movies that have been recorded during these events where a person can be acting as the pilot, flying this airplane around, doing all kinds of fancy maneuvers. Periodically, you fly the airplane toward the controller on the ground, and you're looking at yourself as this object on the ground with the headset, and you're seeing what the aircraft sees. You got to be careful you don't get control reversal when you're looking at things backwards like that. But can you imagine flying an airplane around, and periodically you're passing by this this object on the ground, which happens to be you. Got to be careful you don't aim for it. This virtual cockpiting for flying has gotten to a pretty fantastic feat. Purely battery-operated electric engines these days, brushless DC motors, have gotten up to the point of 3,500 watts total, which is around 4 or 5 horsepower. And these things will run for 4 or 5 minutes long. We're up at the point now where the electric-powered airplanes, which used to be fleet power, are now considerably higher in power than the gasoline engines that used to be used. These aircraft will fly higher, faster, longer, and quiet. In some cases, the only sound you hear is the sound of the air hitting the propeller, or the propeller sweeping past the wing on each rotation, so to speak. A couple of the aircraft, really high-power aircraft, one of them, I try to remember, it's called Blizzard. the Blizzard aircraft, a fairly popular battery-operated, electric-powered radio control aircraft. The thing will fly about as fast as 160 miles an hour level when you make it run full speed ahead. If you aim it straight up in the air, the thing will go out of sight in about 7 or 8 seconds. Man, does that thing have a high climbing rate. Some of these really high-power experimental aircraft that I've seen on this field make an extreme amount of noise when the engine is run full speed because the tips of the blade are breaking the speed of sound. That's a high-powered aircraft. When it comes to radio-controlled helicopters these days, my goodness, they can do all kinds of tricks that no real helicopter, no real helo can do that, like fly upside down, inches off the ground. They call it the lawn-mowing operation. And these aircraft can literally fly on edge where the main rotor is thoroughly perpendicular to the ground. Of course, they flip back and forth periodically between them, rolling slightly to the left and slowly rolling slightly to the right in order to pick up lift because the main rotary blade being perfectly perpendicular to the ground could not stop the gravity from bringing the aircraft down. And one of the really young flyers is only 5 or 6 years old who was doing some very fancy maneuvers with one of those aircraft a couple of years ago. Fascinating stuff. That particular event, the Neat Fair, takes place on Friday, Saturday, Sunday is the main event, and it's approximately the second weekend in September every year now for the last 6 or 7 years. And it's run by a group of guys on Long Island, or Mr. Tom Hunt from the Long Island Silent Flyers, I think is the name of the group. No, is it? Yeah. I'm trying to think of the name of his actual group, organizes this. So if you have the slightest interest in, let me drop, brushless DC motors, high efficiency feeding systems, quiet aircraft, high maneuverability, high power, radio control, cameras, remote piloting, and viewing everything from the cockpit, so to speak, on the ground, and taking photographs. I mean, the best picture they've got of the field where they do this flying, which is a very large recreational camp for recreational vehicles called Pleasant Valley. The best photograph they've got of that facility where they do all this flying was done from one of these aircraft. One of these aircraft went up at a couple thousand feet, aimed the camera at the field, and took a picture. The event draws something like 300 pilots and something like 300 vendors of model aircraft hardware. So it's a pretty big deal. Toledo, Ohio used to be the biggest event of a similar nature. And now the Neat Fair in Schnabel, New York, I think is considerably larger. That's my impression. Anyone any further? And by the way, some of those guys flying those aircraft are using their ham radio license in order to have their own private frequency. For a while, that was the easiest way to have your own private frequency, so you didn't have to worry about interfering with somebody else's transmitter or receiver on their radio control aircraft. Nowadays, digital control on the 2 gigahertz band is so popular, and the digital control has so darn many different codes that can be transmitted, post-code modulation, that individual transmitters jamming each other are almost a thing of the past. They used to have to impound all of the transmitters to make sure that somebody wouldn't turn one on at the wrong time and crash somebody else's aircraft. I think that's almost not required now that people are using digital control on the 2 gig frequency range. KQLIW listening, this is the TechNet. And with any further questions or comments on what you've heard so far or brand new questions, give me your call letters right now. KQLIW.
None of these questions,
okay, we had a triple that time. I heard N2EO. Who were the other people?
WS2N.
Paul was the second guy. Who was the third guy?
AA2Y
something. Very, very noisy. Okay, Rich first, and hopefully you can do something about the noisy signal by the time we get back to you. AA2Y blank. N2EO, go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, yeah, pretty straightforward question. You know that that AL-1500 amplifier for the low bands that I modified with the other two a few years ago.